Major Cochrane, Real 10. We were talking about your leave in Cairo, and you were talking about the Gezira Club in season.
Well, I think in season they had racing there probably 2 days a week. And that was always fun, because it was very pretty, you know, after the desert, green turf, and white buildings, and big trees round about, and the jockeys all in their coloured suits. Very like, I don't think you've seen any of the Doofy's paintings of race courses, or even Degas' paintings of race courses, a lot of like that. But one was told that every jockey there had been warned off the turf, either in France or the UK, or many of them warned off the turf in Australia. And
for cheating?
Yes, and was told whether it's true or not, that every race was rigged. And so unless you knew whose turn it was to win the race, your money made it, your head was literally unfluttered. You're just throwing your piastre notes into the breeze.
Now, in October, you had your first action. Could you tell us that story?
The idea was to tickle up the Italians. And they had, if you like, they'd done the same thing as we had done. We had these rather loosely formed boxes, the idea being it was going to force any invasion force further into the desert and away from the sea. They had built a series of fortified camps, much more fortified as camps than our rather sort of loose structure. And as a kind of dummy run, it was decided to have a night raid in battalion strength on one of these camps, which was by the shore.
Now that would be the Makhtila camp, would
that's
it?
That's right, yes. And so this meant a night approach.
Now what preparations did you make for that? That they we're not, you know.
Really done, I think. I mean, as far as the platoon level was concerned, David Douglas came back from the CO's operations department, the order group, and told us. Us being in the first instance, no, I think I was going to say, in the first instance, the two PSMs and me, that we were going to raid this camp, that we were going to do it with two companies forward, one of which was going to be C. The object was a raid, nothing more than a raid, but the object was to get into the camp. Do what damage we could, take any prisoners, and then get out again the way we come. And that the information was what sort of weapons they had and how many people there were. And that was all pretty vague. But that our recce unit, which I think was at that time was the 11th Hussars, who were acting as kind of forward scouting elements with armoured cars. They were manning or holding the start line, and the start line was going to be pegged out with white cloth so that in the dark we could see actually where our beginning point was. And I think it was supposed to be a surprise attack, so there was no artillery support, there was to be no barrage, as I recollect.
And wasn't that the second time? Exactly. Was that not the time in December that it was quiet approach?
Oh, that was a very heavy barrage, but a very short one.
Right, but you don't remember a barrage before the October?
I don't remember.
Now, what about the approach? You went by lorry, didn't you?
Well, so far, the start line, to reach the start line, we marched or went on foot. And of course, the advance to the camp was on foot. I think it was A Company bumped the enemy outpost first, and there was some firing, and then there was a tremendous amount of machine gun, all with tracer, most of it up into the sky. It looked like a wonderful firework display. They didn't, as I recollect, have star shells to fire to sort of illuminate proceedings. Donald Bannerman was David Douglas was not commanding the company at that time. It was still Donald Bannerman.
Not Alan Cameron.
Now he had come back to join the company, but I remember it was Donald Bannerman because at one point the company was out of harm's way in a wadi, and he called the officers together. David Douglas had been pushed away from the company and replaced by an officer called Alan Cameron, because giving us orders what we're going to do under this canopy of tracer fire, where he suddenly realized that Alan and I both had our army pistols in our hands, and there was pointing straight at his face and chest. And he said in a very angry, testy voice, quite likely, "Put those bloody things away, they're dangerous." Which seemed to be an apt remark at the time. And then, anyhow, the upshot was that I was to take from 15 platoon, take a group forward and see what we could see. And so it was easy enough by this time because we could aim wherever the fire was coming. And it was a bit of a force, really, confusion. We found some lorries, we found the drivers, I think, or something, Libyan conscripts. The Italians had formed units out of native troops. So we took a prisoner or two. By this time, I suppose there must have been at least two sections of this murder. Really almost a whole platoon, and by this time we have started making noise, smashing up the lorries.
You destroyed them?
Yes, set fire to them. There were three of them, I think, and one of them we kept. I thought it would be easy to ride back in and save a long walk. But I sent back, only needed for that a few people, so I sent the rest back under Sergeant Horbury, who was very indignant later about this.
Why?
Well, because he was just in the fun, you know. He was, in for a dig. And if I was there, he reckoned my platoon sergeant, Johnny would have been there too. I did keep PSM Bain, like two or three in his platoon. So about five of us, I think, six of us, stayed there. Kept behind, but it got too dangerous because the Libyan proved not to be a competent driver. I mean, he couldn't get out of bottom gear, so he rumbled along, making a hell of a din.
Couldn't one of you have driven?
I suppose I enjoyed the rest of my head. I presume it would have been no different from any other vehicle. Very noisy diesel.
It's just you'd presumed he was more familiar with it than you.
Well, this is my at the time, and it seemed also a sort of convenient way of keeping the prisoner. You know. But it was now very obvious where we were, and they began firing heavier stuff at us, and it sounded like sort of anti-tank ammunition of some sort. It certainly wasn't light machine gun fire. And so I decided to abandon. The moon had come up too, illuminating things far too brightly. So I decided to abandon the thing and smash it up and set fire to it and lig it. So we hoofed it back. And by good fortune rather than anything else, because we had made a wide semicircle in the area of the camp, but we came out on the start line just about the right place by sheer luck, with one prisoner escaped in all the melee, and one prisoner, and we'd also grabbed some papers, which I imagine were actually no use whatsoever. But it was, as I've said in that book, it was very useful, certainly for C Company, Charlie Company, to realise that in action there's a hell of a noise going on. But noise isn't dangerous, it's merely rather alarming. And if you can realise this, the thing sort of drops into proportion. In other words, you'll get you begin to appreciate what real dangers are, not these imaginary ones which are just bang, bang, bang and flashing lights. And it was A Company had some casualties, but we luckily didn't have any, so it was I think probably most units' first action is a shambles, but that was a very convenient shambles to have.
Now afterwards, you had to, you were interviewed by a war correspondent. Do you remember which one it was?
No, I can't remember now at all.
You don't remember that?
No. All I do remember was that somebody gave me or sent me or got from Cairo over a paper in which the report was in. And I really was ashamed of what the chap had written, because I thought, well, everybody will think this. I told him all this. And it really was a sort of ludicrous tale of daring do. I don't really seem to think I had at least if they did, they were too decent and polite to tell me so.
Now, Colonel Cameron went in November, and that's when you got Colonel Anderson.
Yes.
Andy Anderson. Yes. And this was a chap, perhaps you talk a bit more now. What was he like then?
Andy Anderson, well, he was sort of middling height. He was a thick-set, burly kind of chap. He had a reddish face, reddish complexion, crinkly grey hair, and a wonderful, I can only describe it as a merry look. I saw twinkle in his eye, and a smile never much from his lips. He was no pushover. I mean, my goodness, if you step out of line, you really could get it from him. He hadn't been a regular soldier for umpteen years, and been through World War I without being able to put a junior officer on the right lines, which meant very firmly telling him when he was on the wrong lines. So he was, but he was very popular in the battalion. Everybody liked Andy. Everybody respected him. He was a very tough disciplinarian. But soldiers don't mind that as long as someone's a fair disciplinarian, i.e. people really cop it when they've done something wrong, but when they know they've done something wrong, when in fact it's a fair cop. Not only the villain who's punished, but what's more important, other people in the battalion feel that that was a merited, a correct punishment. But also, of course, if the same chap knows the name of all these soldiers, talks to them, remembers about somebody had some news about having twins some time ago, remembers all these things. Well, and if he's a, this makes a man a good leader, I think. And Andy was a marvelous leader. And this worked right down to every private in the battalion.
Now, you must have been getting to know your privates pretty well by then. Had any sort of characters come out? You mentioned a couple of hard cases, Patterson, Matthews, 37 Smith.
Well,
what do you think? I mean, perhaps you don't remember them particularly individually now, but
how
were you getting on with them, and were there any characters?
I mean, because we, as I said, back at in the Bagoosh box, nothing to do in the evening. We just used to yarn, and so one heard lots of stories, and it was one did get to know people in those conditions. Well, both of them, I think, were there were other people in the company in the same way. People who, in barrack life in a town, had been bored silly and had got rid of the boredom by going doing the tune or getting tight, doing this, that, and the other. We had a Corporal McIntosh in the company, in another platoon, not mine. And he was, I mean, he'd been promoted, he'd been reduced to the rank, promoted again, all because of, he got a bit wild when he had a drink or two. Nothing savage, but just obstreperous. And the same thing with Smith. Of course, in the army, every soldier has a number, and someone like Smith or Millo, let alone us, with umpteen Camerons, McKenzie's, McDonald's, he's always the last two numerals of his army number that was added onto his name for official purposes. So 37 Smith was, I think it was 37, not 9. He was one of our mini Smiths. Now he was like Tosh, Corporal McIntosh. He had he was a good soldier, but he got bored too easily, and when he got bored too easily, he got drunk too easily. But in conditions where you couldn't get drunk, and you were never bored, because we were always doing something, he was absolutely first class. He ended up by getting the DCM. I think if he'd had a slightly better record of service with fewer red inks entries on it, he would have got to know, quite apart from being decorated for gallantry, he would have got, you know, he should have been a, ought to have been a, if he had a cleaner record, at least only warrant officer.
Now, at the same time, you got the MC as well.
Yes, I think very undeservedly for that that raid thing, because it was I didn't feel it. In fact, I was like feeling ashamed of what this war correspondent said. I really felt rather ashamed of this. I was rather very chuffed to get it, mind you. I thought I hadn't done any more, for instance, than PSM Bade had done. Except, well, anyhow, I was chuffed to get it, but I didn't sort of feel, goodness, this, how well deserved this is.
Now, the next thing I think we should look at is December the 5th, you go up for the Wavell Offensive.
Yes.
What do you remember of that? Because that was there was quite an amount of secrecy before you started, wasn't it?
Well, it was, yeah, totally. Because Cairo, of course, was an absolute hotbed of gossip. It was full of in those this was pre Germany coming in, but full of Italian, large Italian population, plenty of fascists, and stores, things could leak like mad from GHQ, away from Mueller's. Various people were very ostensibly high command people set off on leave for various reasons. You know, Christmas is coming. It was a quote, secret unquote, order was prepared. There was going to be in December, when things were quiet, a sort of divisional manoeuvre was going to take place, a divisional exercise. And this story, of course, got out very quickly. And this accounted for the fact that troop movements were made, people were sent here and there and so forth and so on. And this mythical exercise accounted for it. We were told we were going on an exercise. It was going to last a big exercise. We'd be actually, you know, live firing, and we'd be it probably would take us a fortnight or 3 weeks testing out supply systems. And, you know, and well, it seemed a very rational thing to do. So we believed it, as did the population of Cairo, or at least the Italian sympathisers.
Now, when were you briefed then?
Doctor, we're well on our way. I mean, we started off this so-called exercise. We had to get in lorries, big trucks, driven by the Indian Service Corps, very well driven too. And we bumped along in the desert sort of all one day, very visibly, you know, clouds of dust coming up from several hundred vehicles. And then, if I've got it correctly, we stopped at dark and were about to bivouac when the order went out, you know, all aboard, and we swung off in a different direction, the right direction, and with only some side lights on, and the Indian drivers were actually marvellous in keeping awake. And we got our real orders. This was going to be an attack on a series of these Italian armed camps. And
which ones? Was this Nibewa and Tumar?
Yes. And so we were going to take those two camps, attack those two camps, and be prepared for follow-up to the actual coast, where Sidi Barrani was been turned into the Italian HQ. And this was really, well, Wavell's general plan, but there's a chap called Connor, who was in charge of what used to be called Western Desert Force. That was the troops in the desert. Alas, he was taken prisoner later. And I think if he hadn't been taken prisoner, some of the later desert fighting would have been had a different result. Anyhow, this tells the real thing. But he had decided that, unlike previous experience of a prolonged shell fire before an infantry attack, he'd do the thing absolutely topsy-turvy from the received wisdom. And there was, we were to drive up in our lorries within a remarkably short distance of the camp, get out, and then leg it. But the bombardment would be very intense on each camp for about 4 minutes. The time it was written to take us to drive up the last little bit, jump out and get forward, then the barrage would stop. But no long preliminary softening up. And of course, it worked like a charm, because he did achieve surprise. And the attack went in. No, there were casualties. But
that was a dawn attack.
Yeah. It succeeded. It succeeded brilliantly. With we're told that the Italian was commanding the camp we attacked, the Baiwa, had by accident or bad luck or good luck been killed, either in the bombardment, the very brief bombardment, or by a stray shot early on. And we did notice later in the campaign, before we were up against the regular Italian army, that if something happened to the general or the commander, that there always seemed to be a gap before anybody else could pick up the reins, and that you sort of knocked the stuffing out of the opposition if by any chance the opposing commander was killed.
And what do you remember of the actual attack?
Big pardon?
What do you remember of the actual attack?
Well, scampering along in front of 15 platoon, yelling like a maniac. We had a company piper. All companies had their own piper. The people who played brass bands, the military band, they were always turned into stretcher bearers, but the pipers were always left to play their pipes. It was the only battle we fought through the entire war flat enough to let the piper blow his pipes, still have some breath. Anyhow, we galloped along with the piper trotting along behind us trying to pipe. There was a parapet, a bit of rather sketchy wire on it, and there was a machine gun post. So we went for that, and that was wiped out.
What do you remember of that?
Big pardon, dear?
How was it wiped out? What do you remember?
Well, that was we were talking earlier about burners, but in fact, we did do the attack that time, six burners, and it was. I think his name was Patterson. Anyhow, he bayoneted the machine gunner. And that, I think, was the only man I ever saw in the whole war being actually pierced with a bayonet. It certainly stopped the machine gun. And then another company passed through the line we held in the perimeter into the centre of the camp. And in fact, the surprise was so complete that there wasn't really much concerted defence. Things like this odd machine gun. The commander of the carrier platoon, he was killed. Carriers being light armoured vehicles that could whiz around carrying a section of soldiers in, useful, this sort of thing. We had two officers killed, as well as four or five NCOs. But I suppose about a dozen or 15 casualties, which wasn't much for an attack on a prepared position. Ah, good.
And what about the Italian prisoners? You took a lot of Italian prisoners.
Yes. There were a lot in the camp, but when we moved on to Sidi Barani, which had been, I suppose, had been a sort of base camp, there seemed to me to be thousands. There were certainly a good many hundred. There'd be quite a battle in the morning at Sidi Barani, and the Argyles had taken a lot of casualties because they had been hit by a really pretty heavy Italian bombardment still in their lorries before they'd got moving and had a lot of casualties. And we were told to carry on. That was the day after we'd attacked.
So you didn't take many prisoners at your camp. Which camp had you attacked? Is it in
Nibewa? Yes.
Nibewa. Yes. So you didn't take many prisoners there?
Well, we did, but nothing like the ones. I suppose there must have been 500 or 600. A battalion's worth, probably. Or a bit more. As far as I can recollect. And they were marched off to sort of get them out of the way. Then, of course, somebody else had the problem of rations and water and feeding them. And then, when this particular bit of the fighting was over, the lorries that had brought us were used for taking the prisoners back. And we had to wait till that was done.